Hello and welcome into this edition of the Daily Perspective Podcast. Mark Congleton here, your sometimes humble host for this hour of observation, insight, and a touch of absurdity from time to time. Hoping you and yours are doing well, that you're healthy and staying safe. It is Tuesday, the 30th day of June 2020, the last day of the month. 6 months has passed. Where did 6 months of our lives go? Oh, yeah. They were eaten by COVID-19, among other things. That 2 weeks to flatten the curve thing really got out of hand, didn't it? How long have we been sequestered? How long have we been tucked away into our little hidey holes and hiding from the bug? It's been a while. It has been quite some time. And hopefully you're doing all right. Hopefully that you and yours, your loved ones, have managed to dodge the bullet. Statistically speaking, most of us, the vast majority of us have. A very small percentage of us have really succumbed to it. And it's funny, I was looking at, hang on a second, let me pull this back up again and see if I can, there it is. You know, I love me some Just Facts Daily. And just a few moments ago, about 10 minutes ago, they posted online this question. If 240,000 people in the United States ultimately died from COVID-19, will the disease destroy more years of human life than accidents? Once again, if 240,000 people in the United States ultimately die from COVID-19, will the disease destroy more years of human life than accidents? Yes or no? Gee, I wish I had the Jeopardy music handy, but I don't. So is the answer yes or no? If you answered no, well, bless your heart, you're wrong. The answer, well, if you answered no, you're absolutely correct, I should say. And 95% of the people surveyed got that answer correct. If 240,000 COVID-19 deaths ultimately occur in the United States, the virus will rob about 2.9 million years of life from all Americans who were alive at the outset of 2020, while accidents will rob them of 409 million years. 409 million. In other words, accidents would be about 140 times more lethal to Americans than COVID-19. Accidents kill around 170,000 Americans per year at an average age of 53, while COVID-19 has thus far killed 126,000 Americans at an age of 77. You see, the age factor is big in this equation. Accidents kill droves of people every year, but this is unlikely for COVID-19 because genetic and immunological research has shown that the virus that causes it is very vulnerable to antibody neutralization and has limited capacity to mutate because of a proofreading function in its genetics. Thus, vaccines and treatments for it are likely to be very effective in the long run. That is, if we can develop a vaccine. We're still waiting on vaccines for things for decades, by the way. But the thing is that the median age for death by COVID-19 is 77. Accidents, it's 53. The amount of human lives, the amount of the lethality factor is much higher for years of human life. That's what I'm trying to get back to. The years of human life lost to COVID-19 will be considerably fewer than the years of life lost to accidents. That is one odd perspective, one way to look at it, but it's one way to remember it. And that is, those are the vulnerable. Those people are the ones who should be concerned and protected. We should be protecting them. They should be protecting ourselves, themselves. So, when people are raising the alarm about COVID-19 and how we're all going to die, it's the end of the world as we know it. You know, it's the end of the world as we know it. It's not the end of the world as we know it. It is dangerous to the elderly, and we've known that since the beginning. Where was the first outbreak? Remember? In the Pacific Northwest, at a senior care facility, we saw people dying. And that's what raised the red flags for us. That's where we saw things beginning to happen. That's what hit the news first, if you'll recall. And we've seen that consistent behavior of this virus from then onward, because it's affecting people with comorbidities, pre-existing conditions, weaknesses in their systems, whose bodies, whose immune systems can't fight back. And that's who is susceptible, and that's who should be protected, and the rest of us actually should be getting on with our lives. Oh, Mark, people are dying in Florida. People are dying in Texas. Didn't you know there's a huge spike? Yes, there's a huge spike in case detection in both of those states. And there is an increase in hospitalizations in both of those states. But, he said, knowingly, the hospital stays are shorter. And the amount of people walking back out the door is much higher. The death rate has dropped, the hospital stays are shorter, and you're not being told that by the mainstream press. And that's something you need to remember. You need to remember, and we'll get into that here in just a few minutes, probably in the second, maybe the third segment this morning, about what someone who is working in a hospital is actually saying about what's going on. And it's beginning to be repeated in areas around the country, not just this one place. We're starting to hear the same news coming out of different places around the country. So, we'll get to that shortly. First up, a bit of absurdity, if you will. A little background. A friend of mine is responsible for me being here today. A very old friend of mine. We're both very old now. And he was working at a radio station. I wanted to get into radio. And when the program director of that radio station basically just tossed me aside and decided I was not worth even considering to be hired, my friend, Glenn Tapley, decided, hey, let me show you a few of the ropes here. And if you want to hang around, if you want to come in when I'm working on a Saturday, you can. And he helped me to really get my first taste of what it was like to work in radio. And as a result, he and I have been friends ever since. We've worked together off and on over the years. We both worked at the Eternal Word Television Network, where he still is, by the way. He's moved out of production into engineering, which was a wise move on his part. And as a result, he's managed to travel the world with their shortwave radio network, doing this and that for the network all over the planet. And me, I'm sitting here next to the dog talking to you. But the thing is that he and I go back a long way to that little AM radio station in Irondale, Alabama, playing really bad Southern gospel music for preachers who would come in and pay for their half hour of time on the air. And he posted something yesterday about the Andy Griffith Show being pulled off of Netflix. And I love the Andy Griffith Show. A lot of people do. And he was saying that he and his wife, Judy, make it a habit every night to sit down and watch a couple of episodes before they go to bed. It's a beloved show by millions of Americans. People just love the show. And it's been around for a long, long time, since the 60s. And Netflix has been showing it up until tomorrow. Today is the last day for you to be able to see the Andy Griffith Show on Netflix. And there are people posting that fact online, but they're not posting the why. And I want to talk about the why, and you'll understand why it fits into the absurdity segment in just a minute. The Andy Griffith Show is one of the most popular shows from the 60s on Netflix. The sitcom is also one of the oldest shows on Netflix, but the Andy Griffith Show is going to be leaving at the end of this day. 8 seasons of the sitcom were released between 1960 to 68 on CBS. All 8 seasons and 249 episodes are currently available today on Netflix, with the original black and white versions. However, after Cheers, The Andy Griffith Show is another CBS classic that will leave Netflix today. That is, in the U.S. The year 2020 has been a bad year for sitcoms on Netflix in the United States, with Friends departing from the platform earlier in the year. The Office and Parks and Recreation will be leaving Netflix by the end of this year. It's a known fact, Netflix has to purchase a specific license for all the shows it streams, apart from the Netflix originals. And although 8 seasons of the Andy Griffith Show are streaming on Netflix, the license for the show is owned by CBS. Hence, the ball was in CBS's court, as it has the power to choose who gets to stream its shows. CBS is reportedly pulling back its content from Netflix. They're going to be putting it on their All Access service, the CBS All Access service. It's still one of the smallest streaming services in the United States. Hence, the studio is no longer renewing its current lineup of shows, such as Criminal Minds and NCIS. It's also taking away the classics, including the animated Star Trek series. The streaming platform Netflix still carries several other CBS shows currently, which will likely follow the same route in due course. These include a lot of the older Star Trek content and the Twilight Zone. Despite its rocky relationship with CBS from a licensing perspective, Netflix still works with CBS for the Netflix originals, such as Dead to Me and Nickelodeon, which have the same parent company as CBS. So, Netflix is not actually pulling the Andy Griffith Show, just to set the record straight. CBS is pulling the Andy Griffith Show from Netflix, and apparently they will be putting it on their CBS All Access channel. And if you don't have the service, then you'll need to subscribe to it to be able to continue watching these episodes of The Andy Griffith Show in the future, if they put it over there. I'm not sure they will. And the reason I am doubtful is because in my friend Glenn's post on Facebook, he included a screenshot. And in that screenshot of The Andy Griffith Show, in the upper left-hand corner, and he points this out in his post, is the little warning. You know, they put a rating of TVG or whatever, and it says TVG, and underneath that it says violence, comma, fear. Violence and fear on The Andy Griffith Show? Really? On The Andy Griffith Show? Really? Now, let me read you what Glenn wrote. Let's see. He said, okay, I'll give that the search for the baseball in the Crenshaw place is supposed to be a bit spooky, but fear? Maybe the great censor minds at Netflix think Barney's gun discharging should be feared. Or could it be Floyd's scissors he wields? I know the giraffe story sends shivers. Maybe the violence comes from Barney accidentally capturing bad guy Brooke is considered violence. Personally, I agree with Judd. It was one of them karate chops that brought Brooke to the sidewalk. The series Narcos, with its share of brutality, gets a pass on violence and fear. It does mention that people will smoke. I suppose Floyd will now hang up his clippers, Howard his violent bowling ball, and the loaded goat will not be part of the Netflix program lineup. I can't quite reason why it had a G rating given the absolute terror. And that's funny. But the reason for the violence and fear thing is not. And here's the reason for the violence and fear comment. That's because, regardless of the fact that the show is a positive portrayal of police and actually shares some great life lessons with people, police shows are being scrubbed from TV right now because they aren't politically correct. The Black Lives Matter movement has frightened so many people into submission that Netflix labels The Andy Griffith Show with a warning that says it contains violence and fear because it paints a positive image of police officers. That's why the violence and fear label is there. And that, my friend, is absurd. The Andy Griffith Show, a comedy, is tagged with inciting violence and fear by Netflix. If that's not absurd, I don't know what is. But these are the times we live in, when a radical Marxist group A group of anarchists has so cowed the entertainment industry that they are afraid to show a comedy series from the 60s. Because, and they must label it to protect themselves as being violent and fear-inducing. I guess we have to admit that at least in the circles of entertainment, Black Lives Matter has won. But not with people who have correctly functioning brains, right-thinking, right-minded people. We see it for what it is. Welcome back to the Daily Perspective Podcast. Hi there. It is Tuesday, the 30th day, the last day of June 2020. Tomorrow is the beginning of July, and this weekend we celebrate our nation's independence with the 4th of July. And hopefully where you live, there's a little sanity left, and you'll have a fireworks show to go to. Hopefully. Because they're being canceled left and right. I mean, it doesn't matter that the president's trying to wave that flag and remind people, hey, the 4th of July is the day to celebrate. And he's going to Mount Rushmore. Gonna have a big fireworks show there. But hey, there are people who are angry about that, you know. They don't want him going there.
Well, how dare he?
Well, because he's the president. And he was elected by the people. And, well, I don't need to explain it to you. You won't accept it anyway. So, God bless you. Have a good day. Yeah, that's what's happening. At any rate, I hope you get a chance to enjoy some fireworks this weekend. I got to tell you, there's really nothing better than a great fireworks show. And I mean a great fireworks show. Because there's something that stirs you deeply when you've seen a good fireworks show. And if you've been to a Disney park and hung around for the fireworks in the evenings in the Magic Kingdom or at Epcot, or really wherever they're showing off a fireworks show, you know how well fireworks can be produced, because Disney does it better than anybody. And if you doubt that, I suggest you go watch one, because they've got everything perfectly timed, the narration, the music, everything, so that the fireworks play a huge part in telling a story. And that's an awesome thing. But still, the run-of-the-mill, the average fireworks show that you'd see on a 4th of July, it's a magnificent thing. With those giant shells bursting in the air, and radio stations playing along and having patriotic music going, and the crowds watching and oohing and aahing, it's a great experience. Something you should take your kids to. And if you have to wear a mask, well, you know, do your thing and stay out of jail, but you still... you should go see a good fireworks show. I think you should. And if you can't go see one, then if you live in a place like I do, just sit around the neighborhood. Yeah, you'll hear it. And your dog will bark and get nervous and hide under the coffee table and be scared to death because the neighbors will be setting off fireworks until the wee hours of the morning. Yeah. Yikes. Well, the Democrat Party not only is attacking President Trump, and this is interesting because this was predicted like last week, they're attacking Mount Rushmore. Yeah, the Democrat Party, last night, from their official Twitter account, they referred to the upcoming Independence Day celebrations at the famed monument as, and I'm not making this up, this is coming from the Daily Wire and it's being reported widely, the Democrat Party referred to the upcoming Independence Day celebrations at Mount Rushmore as, quote, glorifying white supremacy. Quote, Trump has disrespected Native communities time and again. He's attempted to limit their voting rights and blocked critical pandemic relief. Now he's holding a rally glorifying white supremacy at Mount Rushmore, a region once sacred to tribal communities. The Democrat Party linked to an article from the far-left British newspaper, The Guardian, which promoted the extreme view that Mount Rushmore is a symbol of white supremacy. Well, the tweet sparked instant and widespread backlash, as it should have. It was quickly deleted by the party after being up for approximately an hour. But thank goodness the internet is forever, and we have copies of it floating everywhere. Political commentator Stephen Miller commented on the tweet. He said, well, gosh, it sure would be neat if there was an entire industry of professionals who could ask the Democrat nominee for president of his party if he agrees with this sentiment that Mount Rushmore glorifies white supremacy. I mean, we still don't even know where he stands on removing statues. They let him out to run around once a week and give a 12-minute statement on something, and then back to basement grandpa. Political commentator Ariel Davidson wrote on Twitter, let the Democrats campaign on taking down Mount Rushmore. If they want to cater to the cultural Marxists, fine, but they'll lose spectacularly. It'd be wise for the Democrats to realize that Twitter is not real life. The cancel campaigns are much louder and obnoxious online than in real life. Matt Walking, he's the Deputy Director of Communications Rapid Response for President Trump's 2020 campaign, tweeted, June 29, 2020, 9:57 p.m. ET. The moment the Democrat Party attacked Mount Rushmore, which features George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Teddy Roosevelt, and Abraham Lincoln as a symbol of white supremacy. The foreign media article the Democrat Party linked to quotes an activist saying, quote, Mount Rushmore is a symbol of white supremacy, of structural racism that's still alive and well in society today. Mark Lauder, the director of strategic communications for Team Trump, wrote, the party of Joe Biden is now attacking Mount Rushmore. Zach Parkinson, Deputy Director of Communications Research for President Donald Trump's 2020 campaign, tweeted out photographs of top Democrats visiting Mount Rushmore. That is a little bit inconvenient. There's Hillary Clinton. There's Joe Biden. There's Barack Obama. Wow. Well, conservatives started warning, as I mentioned last week, that the political left was going to begin targeting Mount Rushmore as violent mobs toppled statues and destroyed monuments across the United States. Meghan McCain wrote on Twitter, hey, we're like 1 week removed from entire cable news panels debating whether or not we should blow up Mount Rushmore. Ben Shapiro wrote on Twitter, so when is our woke historical revisionist priesthood going to insist on blowing up Mount Rushmore? South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem responded to Shapiro's tweet with four words. Not on my watch. Good for her. Good for her. So the speculation has become reality. Even though after an hour, the Democrat Party pulled it down, we still have the screen grabs of their tweet. So we know exactly where they really stand. You don't have to ask, hey, how do you really feel? We know. We know. Once again, let me repeat what they actually posted to Twitter. Trump has disrespected Native communities time and time again. When was that? I'd like to ask. He's attempted to limit their voting rights and blocked critical pandemic relief. Really? When was that? Can you please provide support for that? Now he's holding a rally glorifying white supremacy at Mount Rushmore, a region once sacred to tribal communities. Glorifying white supremacy, is that so? Only by the demented leftist definition can any of these be true. Only by ignoring reality and the facts can any of this be considered at all. Because it is the demented worldview of progressivism, of leftism, radical Marxism. And that is what's driving the Democrat Party today. They have effectively given up hiding the fact that they're nuts and just decided to march proudly in their nut suits because they don't care who knows anymore. Well, they didn't care for an hour and then they took it down. But it was up for long enough for us to know. And good thing, too. because, doggone it, we need this kind of stuff to pass it around. And I encourage you to get the show notes today. Go to dailyperspectivepodcast.com or just look for them to pop up. They'll be on. If you're listening to the podcast, well, if you're listening to the podcast, odds are the show notes are already up. And if they're already up, grab them. Grab this article and pass that screen grab around. Because it needs to be. People need to see what the Democrats, what the party actually believes. We need to remove all doubt. Because there are a lot of people who still doubt. Sadly, too many Americans today don't pay attention to politics for one reason or another. Because they think it's dirty and they don't want to get their hands dirty. Or because they're too interested in their movies or their graphic novels or their video games. But whatever reason, they need to see the insanity of the left. To understand that these people don't represent America and they never have. The mask is coming off. And now we're seeing exactly who and what they really are. And every day, they're just making our resolve stronger for Election Day. Because we know we can never allow these people to have control of our country ever again. Welcome back to the Daily Perspective Podcast. Hi there. I'm scanning social media during my break. If you're listening to the podcast, you don't get breaks. You just get this bumper music. Me, I get to drink coffee, eat my snacks, and scan social media. It's kind of sad news. One of the most prolific entertainers in the history of show business has passed away. Last night, Rob Reiner passed away at his Beverly Hills home. Or Carl Reiner, I should say. Not Rob Reiner, his son. Carl Reiner passed away last night at his Beverly Hills home. We're told his family was with him when he passed away. Reiner was a producer. He was a director. He was an actor. He was also a Grammy winner. He won 9 Emmys in over 7 decades. He has more than 400 credits. If you're younger, you probably caught him in Toy Story 4. For most people, most folks remember Carl best for the Dick Van Dyke Show. He created and starred in the Dick Van Dyke Show. He played the role of a very temperamental comedian, Alan Brady, who terrorized Dick Van Dyke's character and the other writers on his show. And he also introduced us to a brand new actress who he cast to play the part of Dick's wife, Mary Tyler Moore. Reiner made a best-selling album with Mel Brooks called 2,000 Years. Remember the 2,000-year-old man? Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks. That earned a Grammy nomination and sparked his writing career. There were other smash hits, including directing Oh God with George Burns, The Jerk with Steve Martin. He worked with Steve Martin on several movies, including Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid, and The Man with Two Brains, and All of Me. Reiner also appeared in a bunch of TV shows and movies, including The Russians Are Coming, The Russians Are Coming, which if you've never seen The Russians Are Coming, The Russians Are Coming, find it and watch it. It's worth your time, trust me. Also, Enter Laughing. His directing credits are endless. Summer Rental with John Candy, Summer School with Mark Harmon, That Old Feeling with Bette Midler, Sibling Rivalry with Kirstie Alley and Carrie Fisher. And Carl Reiner appeared in a lot of TV shows, too. 2 and a Half Men, Hot in Cleveland, House. He was also in Ocean's 11 and Ocean's 13. Carl Reiner. He is a show business legend. He really is. And a lot of fond memories were made by that man. He will be missed. Sad news. Sad indeed. Wow. All right then, moving on. Let's see here. Where was I going with this? Oh yeah, this. This is more like the absurd side of the story, so let's tackle it first. How about that? Restaurant menus have gone on a diet as dining areas reopen after the month-long coronavirus lockdown, and it may be a while before the slimmed-down versions go away. For example, Denny's wiped away options that included its Sizzlin' Supreme Skillet, Choconana Pancake, Spicy Shiraka Burger, Fit Slam, and Slow-Cooked Pot Roast through at least this fall. That's what CNN is telling us. John Dillon, he's their chief brand officer at Denny's, said, "When we realized the effects of the pandemic, we quickly mobilized to create a new streamlined menu." Denny's, he says, is focusing on items it would simplify operations that are easier to execute for our team members. Now, I think that's kind of interesting that they're going for simplifying and making things easier for their team members, and that's their motivation. And why would that be? Is it because they're having trouble keeping qualified people in the kitchen? Is it because they're having trouble hiring people who'd rather get their money from unemployment plus the bonus, which amounts to more than they're making at Denny's? I think that's probably right. Yeah. IHOP has done a lot of the same things. They've taken stuff off the menu. Others as well. And McDonald's has done so as well. I'm looking to see what else we got. But that's all that's in the article. There's more detail if you want to read the whole thing. It's in the show notes today. But Gordon Ramsay would say good, because a big menu doesn't mean you're a good restaurant. It just means you have a big menu. If I've learned anything from Kitchen Nightmares, it's that one of the things you do is you trim your menu back. You focus on what you do well and do that. And bring people back. Have them coming back for what you do well. It's not the fact that you do more of it. It's the fact that you do what you do well. That has nothing to do with the coronavirus. It's just good operation for a restaurant. And if anybody would know about good operation for a restaurant, I think it's probably Gordon Ramsay. But time and time again, what he does on that show is he trims the menu back to just a handful of items. It gives people choices, meat, chicken, fish, that sort of a thing, and an excellent dish with each. And it gives you a good choice. And of course you can change your menu up from time to time, but you don't grow your menu. You just change it up to make it simple. And the best restaurants seem to have that going for them. At least I've found in my life. But we're not talking about the best restaurants here, are we? We're talking about Denny's, IHOP, and McDonald's, where a lot of people go, and they're simplifying their menus. Will these choices come back? You betcha they will. Once things get back to semi-normal, stuff will come back. But how long will that be? That's a good question. That's a very good question. And now to the other side of the story, as far as COVID is concerned. I was scanning through Twitter last night and ran across this tweet. And it says, "Wondering what's really happening in Texas? Here's the email from a senior executive at a Texas ER chain that sees thousands of patients a month. He went on the record, a brave move. I'm going to let him speak for himself." There's a couple of different tweets of screenshots here, so I'm going to try to get to all of them. First up, "Good morning. I'm the managing partner and general counsel of a Texas-based company that owns and operates 13 freestanding emergency clinics in the state of Texas. I follow your reporting and wanted to share with you some information on Texas. I want people to hear this story as opposed to the mainstream reporting. However, I'm sensitive about putting a target on myself or my company for conveying this information. I'm not sure how you've handled this type of situation, but I suspect you've had other people send you information who are concerned about becoming a target. In June, we tested over 2,231 patients, data through last Thursday. Positive rate is now close to 20%. It was 4 to 6% positive in May. Vast majority of the cases are mild to very mild symptoms. Average age of the people getting tested is mid-30s. Very different patient in terms of age than we've seen before June. Most of these patients would not have met the strict criteria that we previously had and all health facilities had for COVID testing. Now, with more testing kits, we are able to test a broader group of patients. Clinically, we've had very few hospital transfers because of COVID. Vast majority of the patients are better within 2 to 3 days of the visit, and most would be described as having a cold, a mild one at that, or the symptoms related to allergies. We've often provided a steroid shot and some antibiotics. By the time we have follow-up calls, most of the patients are no longer experiencing any symptoms. They often say, the shot really made a difference. In terms of what is driving them to the ER, roughly, he divided it oddly. Roughly half have been told by their employers to get a test. They have a sneeze or a cough, and their employer tells them to go home and get tested. The other half just want to know. They have mild symptoms, and some don't have any symptoms, but game the system and check a box that they have a symptom so they can get a test. They cannot get a test unless they present with symptoms. If they have no symptoms, we send them away. And this does happen. In terms of information from within hospital systems, intel provided through contacts, and there's some of it whited out here. The average length of stay of COVID patients is 3 to 5 days, much lower than the patients being seen in April or early May. You see, this is what I was talking about earlier. The length of stay is shorter now than it was before. Symptoms are also milder. Most of these patients are not ending up in the ICU. The hospital ICUs are filled with really sick people with non-COVID issues. They didn't come in earlier because they were scared, and now they are super sick. From multiple sources at different hospitals, they have plenty of capacity and no shortage of acute care beds. No real data on breakdown of patients who have COVID but are not in the hospital because of COVID. Recognition that because all patients are tested for COVID, you have some percentage of patients listed as COVID patients who are non-COVID symptomatic, and that the hospitalization rate is somewhat driven by hospitals taking in their normal patients with other medical issues. Finally, heard several stories of how discharge planners are being pressured to put COVID as primary diagnosis, as that pays significantly better. Hospitals want to avoid the discussion, but if they don't, they risk another shutdown. This may be an explanation for why there is a gap in hospital executives saying they have plenty of capacity and the increasing number of COVID hospitalizations. You open up your hospitals for normal medical care and you test every one of those patients. The result is higher percentage of patients who have COVID. Okay, and since you have COVID, now those patients are listed as COVID patients. Something else to pass on. Since COVID hit, our ER volume decreased 50% in the month of April, year over year. However, our percentage of level 5 ER claims, that's the highest level and very high acuity patients, has doubled. The patients that did come in often waited much longer than they should have and normally would have. People were just so scared. We had one patient, he said, one. Overall, based upon what we're seeing at our facilities, the above information is really more of a positive story. You have more people who are testing positive with minimal symptoms. This means the fatality rate is less than commonly reported. And I have the link to this in today's show notes. And the reason it was a little bit disjointed is because these are screenshots. So I'm going through screenshots and I get to the bottom of one of them and part of that is quoted in the next one. And sometimes it's not. But the overall picture is, a lot of people are in the ICUs at hospitals in Texas today. And remember, they're talking about they've hit capacity. They're in the ICUs because these are people who were sick with other things, who were afraid to come out before they lifted the lockdown. They were afraid to go to the hospital beforehand, but now they're not. And as a result of waiting while they were afraid, their condition got worse. And because their condition got worse, they're in intensive care when they may not have been had they come in earlier. But they didn't because they were scared. We're seeing a lot of numbers that aren't being reported faithfully and truthfully. We're hearing a lot of scary information that when you look at the details really isn't scary after all. Because people aren't as sick and they aren't staying in the hospital as long.
Sacrifice, dogs and cats living together, mass hysteria.
Wow, that's the impression you get when you watch the news today, at least. It's the final segment for this last day of June 2020, the Daily Perspective Podcast. I've had this in my stack for a couple of days now. I've been trying to find a way to wedge it in, and it's long. I may not get to all of it, but I want to share it with you. It's an article by David Limbaugh on the Daily Wire. It's called America's Survival Hangs in the Balance. So let me dive in here real quick. Hopefully I can get through enough of it. But I really, really want you to get the show notes so you can get the link to this article, okay? Because you need to read this article. Here we go. How long can this nation survive when its main cultural and educational institutions preach a relentless, unchallenged stream of anti-Americanism to young people and others who lack the background to resist this toxicity? Along with others, I've long argued that the American left has a major problem with America as founded. Yet Democrats are outraged by the suggestion, and too many Republicans seem insufficiently concerned about it. They better wake up. If current events aren't enough to turn your head, please consider the following data presented by Eric Kaufman, professor of politics at the University of London Berwick College. Kaufman writes that the cultural revolutionaries who are toppling statues and renaming buildings are changing minds and could be in a position to enact a root and branch reconstruction of America into something completely unrecognizable to its present-day inhabitants. He adds, imagine a country whose collective memory has been upended with a new constitution, anthem, and flag, its name changed from the sinful America to something less tainted. Far-fetched? Not according to data I've collected on what liberal white Americans actually believe. Notice Kaufman isn't talking merely about the extreme left, but American liberals. This is chilling stuff, but unsurprising to me. In my book, Guilty by Reason of Insanity, I warned that socialism is not the only terrible idea the left is promoting. I wrote, the left isn't turning to socialism just because its members think it's more equitable than capitalism, but also because they seek revenge against America's founding generation and its successors of beneficiaries. They want to eradicate the Western tradition that spawned our unique American culture because it allegedly led to continental larceny against Native Americans. It is irredeemable moral debt over slavery and is forever culpable for oppressing minorities and women through white privilege and the inherent exploitation of capitalism. I don't claim to be a prophet, but it is my statement not vindicated by America's present turmoil? Kaufman polled American liberals to gauge their willingness to jettison the country's cultural identity. On May 7th, before the George Floyd killing, he surveyed a sample of 870 Americans who lean young, liberal, and white. The group was not representative of the American population at large, but drawn from the Amazon, Mechanical Turk, and prolific academic survey platforms used by thousands of academics. He consciously removed conservatives and centrists to focus only on self-described liberals. He presented them with 16 outlandish statements and was amazed by their answers. He surveyed them again on June 15th, after the Floyd killing and subsequent protests, and found that things had gotten even crazier. He asked them to agree or disagree that Americans should, one, rebalance the history taught in schools until its voices and subjects reflect the demographics of the population and heritage of Native people and citizens of color. Two, move, after public consultation, to a new American anthem that better reflects our diversity as a people. Three, rename our cities and towns until they match the demographics of the population. Four, rebalance the art shown in museums across the country until an analysis of content shows that it reflects the demography of the population and perspective of Native people and citizens of color. Five, move after an open public process to a new name for our country that better reflects the contributions of Native Americans and our diversity as a people. Six, rename our states until they better reflect the heritage of Native people and citizens of color. 7. Gradually replace many older public buildings with new structures that don't perpetuate a Eurocentric order until a more representative public space is achieved. 8. Respectfully remove the monument to four white male presidents at Mount Rushmore as they presided over the conquest of Native people and repression of women and minorities. 9. Allow our public parks to return to their natural state before a European sense of order was imposed upon them. 10. Move, after public consultation, to a new American flag that better reflects our diversity as a people. 11. Consider adopting a new national language that will be forged from the immigrant and native linguistic diversity of this country's past. 12. Remove existing statues of white men from public spaces until the stock of statues matches the demographics of the population. 13. Gently remodel the Statue of Liberty to make it better reflect the diversity of America. 14. Rename our streets and neighborhoods until they match the demographics of the population. 15. Move, after public consultation, to a new American Constitution that better reflects our diversity as a people. And 16. Begin changing the layout of our cities, towns, and highways, moving away from the grid system to follow the more natural trails originally used by native people. Kaufman reports, every one of these proposals represents a radical blow to American culture, cultural nationhood. Yet, six of them carry the support of more than 50% of committed liberals. Eight are backed by a majority of the 40% of liberals who identify as very liberal. Some 80% of those who have made up their mind would replace the national anthem and Constitution. Assuming the survey is remotely scientific and representative of liberal thinking, it should be uncontroversial to say that the American left wants to radically transform America. After considering this data and the left's support and sympathy for the violence, looting, and anarchy sweeping this country, could it be any clearer what's at stake in the 2020 elections? I respectfully appeal to reasonable people on both sides of the political aisle to recognize what's happening to the greatest nation in history and oppose it before it's too late. These kinds of revolutions don't end well for anyone, including the nihilists who engineer them. Assuming this survey is remotely scientific and representative of liberal thinking, it should be uncontroversial to say the American left wants to radically transform America.
Fundamentally transforming the United States of America.
Gee. I wonder where that idea came from.
We are 5 days away from fundamentally transforming the United States of America.
The results of this survey support what I've been telling you for quite a while, and that is that the left in America wants to scrap what this nation is and rebuild it from the ground up based on their ideology. This is what's happening in our streets today. This is what's happening around America. Let me say this, as I've said before. This, what's going on in the streets, these people pushing down statues, these people breaking into private subdivisions and threatening the lives of homeowners, these people, all of this activity, none of it has anything to do with the death of a black man in Minneapolis, Minnesota, by the name of George Floyd. Nothing. It has everything to do with
fundamentally transforming the United States of America.
That's what all of this is about. It's about that fundamental transformation. If you've been wondering what Barack Obama has been up to since he left office, you're seeing it on the news every day. If you've been wondering what his Obama for America group, his organizing group, his community organizing group has been doing, you're looking at it. And no, I'm not being far-fetched. And no, I'm not reaching. This is what they've been up to. And now we're seeing the fruit of 8 years of an Obama presidency. We're seeing the fruit of him putting thousands of like-minded people into positions in the American government. We're seeing the fruit of the Obama administration planting seeds across America and watering those seeds for the entire 8 years he was in office, plus the entirety of the current Trump administration. We're seeing those seeds come to bear. We're seeing them grow. And now they're in our streets destroying property across America. Because that one man represents a movement. And that is why he became president. Because it was all orchestrated to get someone in power who could do something to undermine the fabric of this nation in the halls of government. That's not insane. If you'll do your research, you'll find the same end. It's all about that fundamental transformation. And that's all I have time for today. Have a great Tuesday. We'll see you back here for the July 1st edition for Wednesday, tomorrow, as the Daily Perspective continues then. God bless. Bye-bye.
Oh, we're done.